Welcome to Beg to Differ, the Bulwark's weekly roundtable discussion featuring civil conversation across the political spectrum. We range from center-left to center-right. I'm Mona Charon, syndicated columnist and policy editor at the Bulwark, and I'm joined by our regulars, Bill Galston of the Brookings Institution and the Wall Street Journal, Damon Linker, who writes the Substack newsletter Notes from the Middle Ground, and Linda Chavez of the Niskanen Center. Our special guest this week is Greg Nunziata, Executive Director of the Society for the Rule of Law. So, Greg, lovely to have you. Thanks so much for joining us. We will begin with Trump's various encounters with the criminal justice system, because we've had a number of developments this week. First of all, the case that pretty much everyone agrees is the most consequential, the most slam dunk, namely the classified documents case from out of Florida, has been postponed indefinitely. So that case is absolutely, any doubts that anybody might have had as to whether that case would ever come to trial before November are now settled. It will not. And it was the most compelling case against him. So there's that. And then there are developments in the New York trial. So I'd like to begin with Greg. Let's talk a little bit about Eileen Cannon and the documents case. Admittedly, it's a complicated case and it involves classified documents, and there's a whole special statute for how you deal with classified materials in a trial and all of that. But even accounting for all of that, she has been unbelievably dilatory from the very beginning in the way that she has handled this. The reason that she says she has so much work to do is because she hasn't even issued the rulings that she was supposed to have issued months and months ago. Am I right or wrong about that?
I try to be modest in assigning blame or motivations for breakdowns with trial court judges. I mean, a lot of things go on in chambers. I was a district court clerk, and sometimes things are more complicated on the inside than they seem publicly. That said, it does seem the case that she's been, for one reason or another, rather slow on this. And you know, I think people have implied ill motive, but there's lots of reasons for this. You know, there's courthouse chatter that she's just been kind of overwhelmed by the pressure and there's been a breakdown and she's lost clerks. There's been staff overturning and some just general administrative chaos. So it may be that she's not cut out for the weight of this, but maybe something else that we don't know. It's fair to be asking questions about whether she's handling this appropriately or whether she's up to the task.
Okay. And there's no question that this does not rise to the level of something that Jack Smith can appeal to the 11th Circuit and say she's not doing her job, right? This is not the sort of thing that he can appeal.
You could try, but it's such a high burden. I mean, judges think well of themselves and they think well of their colleagues, and they are very, very reluctant to take a matter away from a judge absent really obvious conflicts or issues that are sort of cut and dry and grave. Just being slow is I don't think going to cut it. I don't think it would be worth the prosecutor's time to try.
Okay. So we also saw this week that the appeals court in Georgia is going to hear the appeal regarding Fannie Willis's eligibility to continue as prosecutor. So any thoughts that case might have come to trial before November out the window? Close observers never thought it would anyway for other reasons, but okay. So that's out. The January 6th case, the Supreme Court slowed things down because it wanted to rule for the ages about presidential immunity. Greg, I think you were one of the people who was somewhat critical of Gorsuch for saying that he has to rule for the ages, right? I mean, you thought they could have.
Yeah, so I mean, there's a fear that if in some quarters, that if presidents, former presidents, are too exposed to potential criminal liability, they'll be afraid to do their job. And we don't want that. So I don't know if it's true or not. I'm kind of actually skeptical that we need any real measure of presidential immunity after they're done serving their term in office. But granting that, it's fair for the justices to worry about it in the abstract. But this case gets nowhere near that line. This is, you know, trying to interfere with an election to stay in office contrary to the will of the voters, contrary to the Constitution, is not performing kind of core constitutional functions. We frankly want presidents to be afraid of getting prosecuted for trying to steal an election. It's not. This is not kind of routine presidenting, if you will. So I think the court could very well just simply say that yes, there might be lines here, there might be a measure of immunity here, but this case does not present even a close call. So we will reserve writing that rule for the ages for a time when we're really confronted with something that is in the ballpark of these concerns.
Right. So, I mean, just to put a pin in that, the issues in this case involve actions that even Trump's attorneys agree were not core presidential duties. They were outside the realm of core presidential duties. They were private acts by a candidate, not presidential acts. And so, anyway, so they didn't really need to take this case and slow things down, but they did. And so now if they're going to make a decision, who knows, it could take until the end of June for them to issue this opinion. And only then could it potentially begin the trial process in Judge Chutkan's court. Again, I'm going to ask for your judgment. Chances that one comes to trial before November.
Maybe I'm too optimistic, but I think there is a real chance that at least some form of fact-finding in the case begins. It's very unlikely you get to a verdict, but it is quite possible, maybe even likely, that either a trial starts or the court does announce some sort of test about what's an official act and then tells the judge to figure out if what's charged here is on one side of this line or the other. And if the judge needs to do that, that's a pretrial proceeding that would involve fact-finding. So I think there's some hope that there would be a degree of fact-finding and a degree of judicial examination of what Trump did in connection with the election. So,
and if the judge says this was all non-core presidential behavior and, you know, it falls within those boundaries, could that be subject to interlocutory appeal? And could the Trump people then appeal that and have it go way up again?
Well, I mean, it depends. It depends on what the test is and how it's applied. But I think it should be. I am hopeful that it'll be a very kind of straightforward test to apply. But yes, theoretically.
Okay, so theoretically, yes. All right. Okay. Finally, and this one I'm going to have the whole panel join in on for their reactions. The New York case. I'm just going to put my cards on the table. I thought the Stormy Daniels testimony was a disaster on many levels. First of all, it's just so tawdry and awful. And I can't believe this is, you know, the way we do business in America now. But anyway, and that, you know, I'm applying that to the voters who put us here as well as everybody else. But, you know, it just feels to me as if, first of all, they did not need to go into all the details about the sexual encounter. Doesn't that feel like, I mean, the voters of this country recoiled from the Ken Starr report and from using, you know, Bill Clinton's sexual peccadilloes against him and trying to humiliate him in public when voters felt that was not germane to his duties or his behavior as president. We can agree or disagree about whether Bill Clinton should have been held accountable for his perjury, but certainly the graphic nature of the Starr report and all of that repelled people and made Clinton more sympathetic. Do you think there's a chance that this kind of thing, where the prosecution has gone into much greater detail than they needed to with the whole Stormy Daniels sexual encounter with Trump, which is really all they needed to have her say is that, yes, the thing happened, right? And for the purposes of the falsifying business records crime, how do you react to any of that? And I want to hear everybody else on this as well.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's a lot to say about this. Well, you know, one, just in the abstract, kind of the underlying facts here are just so tawdry. And in a pre-Trump era, it would destroy a campaign, which is why, of course, we're here, because Trump's folks knew that it could destroy his campaign. And now we almost shrug it all off. And of course, that happened. And we're just talking about this, the legal potential legal implications. I've been kind of confused by why both sides, frankly, on the testimony of Stormy Daniels have gone so deeply into the details, because it doesn't seem to be all that credible. You're right. I mean, the question is, did what the government is trying to prove is that he falsified business records in connection with a scheme to avoid a damaging allegation coming out about him before the election. You don't need to really even show that this interaction between the two of them happened. You just have to show that she was alleging it. So, I mean, I suppose they wanted to get a bit about the gravity of it, how serious it might have been, her credibility, but it does seem like I think both sides are taking some risks by how deeply Stormy Daniels was on the stand for 2 days, which seems a lot more time than she spent with the former president. So,
good point. Damon, what do you think?
Well, we all here lived through the whole Clinton business and the Starr report. That was a long time ago. But the irony of this whole thing is, of course, Trump wanted to pay her off so the story wouldn't come out and damage his campaign. And the reality is all of it has come out and none of it has damaged his campaign. So in a way, he was being a little old-fashioned and uptight about the state, the degraded state of American public life, that he thought that this actually would matter. And it didn't, just as the Access Hollywood tape didn't matter. Now, I mean, did it matter? Maybe Trump would have won in 2016 maybe he would have won the popular vote and gotten 49% of the vote instead of 46, if all these allegations hadn't come out and depressed his vote a little bit. But, you know, in the end, he did win, and he even came remarkably close in the Electoral College in 2020. So it's all of this seems like a weird, almost after echo of a moment in our culture, our political culture, that is long past due. I mean, Trump was just on Truth Social, I think it was on Wednesday this week, talking about some figure, and he said, "Oh, that person looks like SHIT." Just comes right out and says that, uses that kind of language in public, which before Trump would have been utterly inconceivable for a politician, let alone someone running for president. So, It's a strange situation that we are in now, and actually I've in a way, maybe this seems off topic a little bit, but I've been thrown back in my recent reflection on some of this to how it's as if our country has been transported back to the 1870s and 80s with social media and all these modern technological things that amplify the kind of sleazy and tawdry character of our country. I mean, I think if you don't know the history, I mean, you might not be aware of just how sleazy American politics was in that post-Civil War era, how turbulent it was with things like two elections where the popular vote winner actually lost the election. You also had a president losing re-election and then running again against his former opponent in a rematch, as well as all kinds of other violence and racism and xenophobia. It was just a really ugly period. And there's a way in which we're kind of back there again, except now we have saturation real-time news coverage projecting it out into the country. And this trial strikes me as very much of our moment in that sense. And I don't see anything good coming from it, frankly. I mean, you know that I've been a skeptic about all of these trials to begin with. This has always struck me as the most trivial of the four anyway. To put Stormy Daniels on the stand for 2 days to go into these kinds of details. I mean, even in the late 90s, during the Starr Report and the Bill Clinton impeachment, it didn't really even hurt Bill Clinton. He came out of there riding higher in the polls by the time it was over than he was before. And we're so
no,
much
hurt
more.
Republicans.
It hurt Republicans for bringing the charges and airing it and trying to bring him down over an affair. And I fear that the end result of this is going to either be a kind of like, it's going to end up being like an even score, that it didn't really hurt him, or that he actually gets a bounce out of it. And that would truly be unfortunate. Even if he's convicted, he's of course going to appeal it. And I don't know, and maybe Greg knows enough about the way the appellate system is going to work in New York to estimate how long that process is going to play out before that gets settled. Is it plausible that there could be a guilty verdict and then he appeals and it gets decided before the election? Or is that something that's going to take a long time to play out? I don't know.
Okay, Linda, your reaction to, I have a feeling you might disagree, but.
It's funny. I heard from a high school friend this week. She's somebody I've kept in touch with over the many years since I graduated high school. She's not somebody who follows politics very much. And her message to me is, are you watching Stormy? There are a lot of people out there for whom politics are not their, you know, day-to-day interests, where exactly the kind of tawdry things that we are hearing have some appeal. I mean, that is why the National Enquirer sells its magazines. It's what people look at when they're standing at the grocery store line. They may not, you know, buy the paper, but they certainly read the headlines. So, you know, as a legal matter, you're a lawyer, Mona, I'm not, but I think as a legal matter, the way in which they introduced maybe more details than were necessary, I think they did have to show a credible witness. I think she did have to demonstrate that there had been a sexual liaison, one night stand, essentially, with Donald Trump in order to make more serious the crime, which was falsifying records, but falsifying records in order to keep this out of the public eye. And while I agree with Damon that Donald Trump might have won the election, he did win the election in 2016, despite the Access Hollywood tapes, I think we forget how horrified many in the Republican Party, how quickly they were dancing away from Donald Trump. Now, what I think in terms of the legal matter, having sat glued to the television, I have to admit, watching, you know, the back and forth, we're not seeing it live, but we're getting reports from inside the courtroom, is that while I think the prosecution may have gone too much into the bedclothes, shall we say, on this particular story, but I think Susan Nicholas, who was doing the cross-examination for Donald Trump, didn't help herself by, you know, trying to get Stormy Daniels to change her story. And instead of changing her story, she just doubled down and she did it apparently quite forcefully. So I don't think this is going to hurt the prosecution. It may help the prosecution. I do think that it's very clear that Stormy Daniels was not a witness that any prosecution would, you know, like to have because she was not controllable. I think they're going to have an even bigger problem when Michael Cohen takes the stand. But I do think people are paying attention, and a lot of people who don't pay attention to January 6th or even to the documents case are paying attention to this.
Bill, so you can respond to anything that you've already heard, but I would also like to probe the matter of the effect on the election. So there are a whole series of polls that show people who are planning to vote for Donald Trump or thinking of voting for Donald Trump, who nevertheless say if he's convicted of a crime and he's a convicted felon, they would reconsider. How seriously do you take that response? Because I'm a bit dubious, just because they might say that now, but that's before the whole, you know, press operation gets in gear to say this was completely fraudulent and corrupt and nobody's ever faced such charges before in New York history, which is, by the way, true. And, you know, this prosecutor had campaigned saying he was going to get Trump. So now they did, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. What do you think?
Well, I beg to agree with you, Mona. that's, you know, I really have been skeptical from the beginning of those poll findings, despite the fact that, you know, I put more weight on good polls than a lot of other people do. But when you look at the stickiness of the attachment, you know, of Trump's supporters to their candidate, I think it's going to require something bigger than this, something where the crime is, you know, more central to politics and to the campaign than this is. And so in this respect, I think the Clinton analogy is probably a pretty good one. You know, I think if Trump loses, it will not be because of this trial. I can't prove that. You asked me for my all things considered judgment. I've given it to you. I freely admit that it's a seat of the pants judgment call. I could turn out to be wrong, but that's what I think as of now. There are two other points that I want to make. First of all, I think Damon's analogy to the 1880s is an excellent one, but with one salient difference, and that is we lack a Henry Adams who can do full justice to our times. You know, perhaps if Tom Wolfe were still alive, he would take a run at it, but alas, he's no longer with us. Second, I am concerned not only about our politics, but also our public culture. And this trial says nothing good about our public culture whatsoever. As a matter of fact, I think it is a coincident indicator, to sound like an economist for a minute, of the depths to which we've fallen. And I am sure that there are lots of people like Linda's friend, you know, who are riveted to their television screens. And, you know, that's human nature, I guess. But it seems to me a public culture is defined by what isn't seen in public, right? Where the line is drawn between things that are fit to be in the public domain and things that aren't. In my lifetime, that line has eroded and all but disappeared. And I think we're all worse off for it. I know I sound desperately old-fashioned, you know, but, you know, when I was growing up in the 1950s and early 1960s, silence was not a vice. And, you know, we were silent about things that we should have spoken about. But at least we weren't speaking about things about which we should have remained silent. And this is an excellent example. And so, you know, as an incipient old man, I'm just registering my futile dismay with no actionable recommendations whatsoever as to the state of our public culture.
Can I just follow up on that with some please, more futile thoughts?
Please do.
But no, I think that's absolutely right. And for all this talk about these lawsuits and the various merits of each of them, I think it's apparent that, you know, courts were not designed to deal with a problem like Donald Trump. And we shouldn't be here. We're here because of like a serious serial failures in the political process, of our leadership, in our culture, a failure of civics. I mean, there's so many junctures where this we had an off-ramp and we didn't take them because we failed as a people, frankly. And so the courts, as a result, are under just tremendous stress, an institutional stress they really should not have to bear. So someone who cares about the institutions and cares about our courts and our constitution. I mean, it's ultimately we have to look at ourselves and look at our culture and think about how we got here and what it would require to restore our culture and to restore a proper sense of civics, to not just be in this endless downward cycle.
Yep, Before we leave this topic, Greg, can you answer Damon's question from earlier about if there were a conviction in New York, and then, of course, it would be appealed, and what would be the time frame in which that is likely to unfold?
Yeah, it strikes me as very, very unlikely. I mean, they'll have a lot to appeal. You know, they moved for mistrial, Trump's lawyers did yesterday, mm-hmm. about Stormy Daniels' testimony being unduly prejudicial. Strikes me as not crazy, that argument. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. so you can imagine there being significant litigation going forward. I don't think you're going to be imprisoning the former president in the interim. And, you know, if he gets elected, this is all untested, but I think the presumption is that a state cannot hold a president in prison and prevent him from doing his job. I think that's what the courts would hold. I think there's very little risk that he will be incarcerated before the election.
Oh, and what about the flaws in the case? Do you think it would survive an appeal, or do you think there's been enough error? Like, the Harvey Weinstein verdict was recently overturned for similar reasons, right? Mm-hmm. That the prosecution allowed in too many things that were prejudicial that they ought not to have. And the judge, sorry to get down into legal weeds here, shows my background as a lawyer, but the judge said, well, you know, you didn't object. You know, that was your job, he said to the prosecutors, right? You should have objected. On his own sui sponte, he corrected the witness at one point. But do you think that just letting in that evidence could possibly be grounds for reversal?
It strikes me as possible. And I've not read the transcript line for line, so don't hold me to this judgment. But it strikes me as possible, but not as fraught as the Weinstein case. I mean, this isn't about Trump's conduct really in that room. It's about falsifying business records and the motivation to cover it up for the election. And I think that case has actually been stronger than I expected going into it. I think the prosecution looks better today than it did before the trial started. And I think mm-hmm. they have a good mm-hmm. chance on appeal, should they get conviction.
Okay. Yeah, right. And of course, I think we would all agree that if there is a hung jury, I mean, there's unlikely to be an outright acquittal, but if there is a hung jury, we all know what's going to happen.
It can also be a misdemeanor. I mean, there's this curious framing to this law. I mean, it's a misdemeanor to falsify business records, and it was a misdemeanor to not report the payment. So the law is,
but if you put them together,
stacking misdemeanors, which I think even if sort of in a law school exam that makes sense, and it seems like he is guilty, I do feel this kind of a sense of injustice out there to that, particularly mm-hmm. when you're dealing with the former president, who you know, much as he talks about two systems of justice, in many ways he gets the better of that.
Yeah. Well, of course, you know, it's just a measure of where we are that he's like the guiltiest man we know, but maybe you can't show it, or certainly not in a timely fashion.
I think it is a shame that this trial went first for.
Agreed. Yeah, absolutely. I do find that Florida case just really maddening, because other people really have done serious time for far less serious endangering of national security than Trump did. And he's going to get away with it. And it is just infuriating. But okay, let's hear a word from one of our sponsors. Did you know that your temperature at night can have one of the greatest impacts on your sleep quality? If you wake up too hot or too cold, I highly recommend you check out Miracle Made's bed sheets. Inspired by NASA, Miracle Made uses silver-infused fabrics to make temperature-regulated bedding. You can sleep at the perfect temperature all night long. It has self-cooling properties for better quality sleep. These sheets are infused with silver that prevent up to 99.7% of bacterial growth, letting them stay cleaner and fresher 3 times longer than other sheets. They're luxuriously comfortable without the high price tag of other luxury brands, and feel as nice, if not nicer, than sheets used by some 5-star hotels. So stop sleeping on bacteria. that can clog your pores. Sleep clean with Miracle. Go to trymiracle.com/beg to differ to try Miracle-made sheets today. And whether you're buying them for yourself or as a gift for a loved one, if you order today, you can save 40%. If you use our promo, Beg to Differ, at checkout. Miracle is so confident in their product, it's backed by a 30-day money-back guarantee. So if you aren't 100% satisfied, you get a full refund. So go to trymiracle.com/beg to differ and use the code Beg to Differ to claim your 40% off. Again, that's trymiracle.com/beg to differ to treat yourself or someone you love. All right. So while we had this incredibly tawdry spectacle going on in the New York City courtroom, we had President Biden giving what I thought was a really outstanding speech about anti-Semitism on Holocaust Remembrance Day. And I thought he really rose to the occasion. But some people are saying, and Linda, I'm going to start with you on this. Some people are saying, well, that was a really great speech. But then to follow it up immediately with a statement to an interview on CNN that he was withholding weapons from Israel because of its moves into Rafah, that he sort of vitiated the point of the speech, that, you know, even though he had claimed he has Israel's back, he really doesn't. So what do you
Well, clearly domestic politics played in the decision to do both of those events, both his comments on anti-Semitism and certainly the interview he gave on CNN. He is worried about losing states like Michigan and Minnesota, and I think there's reason for him to worry, particularly Michigan. It has a very large Arab population. I believe it's the largest Arab population in the U.S., and he absolutely must win both those states. So so I can understand his trying to soften a bit the fact that the United States is Israel's closest ally, has given Israel enormous amounts of military aid over the years and just recently. Now, it's not as if this is the first time that a U.S. president has decided to hold, you know, some weapons back. And so
right.
This isn't a break with Israel or anything like that. You know, I'm going to withhold judgment on whether it was the right thing to do or the wrong thing to do. Apparently, they have tried very, very hard in talking privately with Prime Minister Netanyahu, with military leaders there. The CIA director was in Israel. So they've tried to make the point that a full-scale bombing and invasion of the Rafah area would be very bad. Bad for Israel, bad for the United States. I was struck by something else, though, Mona, and I just want to get it in here. You know, we hear all this worry about Joe Biden and his cognitive decline. It was a very lucid interview. I thought he did very well in terms of the way he talks, his command of the issue. And so, you know, I know there aren't probably a whole lot of people who are going to look at it that way, but I'm withholding judgment on whether this is going to be very bad. Clearly, Republicans and Trump are going to try to take advantage of it. But, you know, I think Israel does have to be careful in how they handle it. I want to see Hamas defeated. I want to see Israel defeat Hamas. But I think more images of children who were killed, you know, as collateral damage is not good for Israel. It's not good for the United States.
So, Linda, I agree about that part. Beg to differ about the interview, but maybe we can come back to that later. Bill Galston, I am a strong Israel supporter, not a shock to anybody who listens to this podcast, but, you know, Netanyahu is an ass. And, you know, it seems to me that Biden and the administration have been telling them for weeks and weeks, you know, that how they feel about Israel going into Rafah. And Netanyahu knows that Biden is in a political vice at the moment. He could have given him some cover. You know, one of the things that the U.S. was asking the Israelis to do was, you know, more to protect civilians and make more of a show of protecting civilians before going into Rafah. And Biden was clearly like bending over backwards to not do this. So I don't know. I blame Bibi here. What do you think?
Well, in my judgment, and, you know, I'm as strong a supporter of Israel, I think, as you are. But, you know, blaming Bibi is always presumptively the right course, you know, because in this, you know, in this case, in Israel, nobody believes a word that he's saying anymore. I gave a little seminar on Israeli public opinion end of last week. And, you know, people want him to resign yesterday. And the level of trust in him as the leader of the country is at rock bottom. Most Israelis think that his political calculus dominates every step that he takes, and they resent it. On the other hand, to infer from that that his policies are unpopular with the public, and if the only he's replaced is, you know, Israel's stance vis-a-vis Gaza will change in some way, is just wrong. I mean, 80% of the Israeli public believes that the only way to end the war is to defeat Hamas everywhere in Gaza, including Rafah. And Israelis who are deeply traumatized individually and as a country are in no mood, you know, to allow Palestinian casualties to serve as a block against the military policies that they believe are essential. So if Biden is trying to prevent an Israeli incursion into Gaza, into Rafah, I think he's going to fail. And I find in the commentariat, American and Israeli, near unanimity on that point. I don't think that Biden was saying what he said to Evan Burnett on CNN because he really hopes that that statement will prevent the incursion. You know, if he's well briefed, he'll know that that's not going to be the effect. So it was a statement intended for domestic political consumption, I believe. And I'm not faulting him for that, because as far as I'm concerned, defeating Donald Trump in November is such an overriding good and goal that I'd be willing to give any president in Biden's situation a lot of slack. Now, you know, as to the merits of what Biden did, I have been troubled for a long time by the use of 2,000 not very smart bombs in heavily, you know, in dense urban areas. It seemed to me that that was flatly inconsistent with any effort to minimize collateral damage. And I've never gotten a satisfactory account as to why it was really necessary to use some of the heaviest bombs and most destructive bombs in our arsenal or in any country's arsenal to do that kind of work in urban areas. So on the merits, as a matter of tactics and as a matter of honoring the laws of war, I think Biden has a point. I really do. If I'd been running the Israeli incursion into Gaza and the war there, I would have refrained from using them. Here's the downside. I have no doubt about the fact that using bombs like that to flatten entire areas has reduced IDF casualties substantially. And I have to believe, and this is true of many kinds of aerial military activities, that was a major driver of this strategy. But I think that it went too far, frankly. And that contributes to my unease about the way the campaign has been waged. That was probably more of an answer than you bargained for, but I haven't said very much about this publicly up to now, and so I felt impelled to say it.
Okay, thank you. Damon, both Bill and Linda stress that, you know, the overwhelming goal of defeating Trump makes them give Joe Biden a lot of slack here. Of course, some people make the argument that this is not going to placate the people who are calling him Genocide Joe. And it will possibly alienate people who strongly support Israel. And therefore, he has achieved less than nothing. What do you think?
Yeah, I pretty much agree with that. I mean, Biden's problem, the reason why we continue to fret over his numbers and the viability of his attempt to defeat Trump in November, is that he's stuck in a kind of pincer on both sides. He has a restive, angry left who despises the way he's embraced Israel over the last 6 months and thinks that we should never have done it in the first place. And if that isn't possible, he should have cut them loose at the nearest possible time after that. And it hasn't happened. And this, as I think Bill indicated, I think does indicate that what's going on here is he's trying to fix this now. Okay, after all these protests on these campuses and people calling him Genocide Joe, he's going to fix this problem by trying to distance ourselves from Israel so that our hands won't be dirty if and when, and I agree it'll probably be when, Israel actually goes full force into Rafah. But of course, doing this is now just going to make it even more difficult to make the play that I would prefer him to make, which is actually to say to the left, all right, you don't want to vote for me? Suck on it. I'm going to actually make a play for the Nikki Haley voters on the other side and try to actually have a realignment where the old sensible rump of the Republican Party does what the people at the Bulwark did, you know, a few years ago and actually become effectively Democrats. Now, would he succeed in that? Not entirely, no. Some of those people, a lot of those people, maybe are just going to go home to Trump and hold their noses and vote for him anyway. But where's even the attempt, the try to make that kind of a move? And instead, you're kind of stuck. He's like in this place where he's going to end up, I think, alienating both sides. The Genocide Joe faction isn't going to say, yay, we love you now, Joe. And the Nikki Haley voters are going to say, see, you're just like the way I always thought Democrats were. You're cutting Israel loose. Now, when it comes to the substance of the policy, the thing that bothers me most as a kind of policy intellectual type is it just doesn't make sense to me. I mean, I'm sorry. Biden did support Israel from the moment October 7th happened, and I've been very happy about that, and I've supported of it. But Israel made clear from the very beginning that its goal in the war was to destroy Hamas slash degrade it to such a degree that it can no longer govern the Gaza Strip and use it as a launching pad to do something like October 7th, and ideally not be able to hurl hundreds of missiles at Israel at will as well. All right. Nothing has changed about that goal, and everybody knows it is not an achievable goal if Israel does not go into Rafah. That means that either Biden is trying to persuade the world that he no longer accepts that goal that he's defended for 6 months now, and that's kind of a big shift. I think we need more explanation than he provided in that interview if he no longer thinks that, and he has to deal with the consequences of the fact that he's now doing a 180. Or it means that he's actually, you know, he said that, but in the end, it's too costly, either in terms of human life, which I have a lot of sympathy for, or for domestic political reasons, to say, actually, I did think that they should get rid of Hamas, but in the end, it's too hard to do it. It's too painful to do it. The costs are too grave. Therefore, we're going to let them keep Rafa. We're going to let them keep the tunnels under Rafa. We're going to let them, dig in, and they'll continue to survive there. And then eventually Israel will fall back, and then we'll be right back where we were on October 6th. And what kind of a foreign policy is this? And what are the motives for this? I mean, so in other words, Biden is either trying to do what I just described, which I think is incoherent as a policy, or he's just doing the other thing that I think rightly suggested. He could just be like trying to signal to the left, like, oh, if they go into Rafah and they're really ugly images of people who got killed and injured, that's not my fault. I told them not to do it. I wouldn't even let them send the bombs. I find the whole thing to be in a kind of microcosm, exactly what hawkish friends of mine who don't like Trump and yet resist voting for Biden have been saying to me for a long time about why people should not just switch over to supporting Biden because he's too feckless. You know, it's the same line that you heard a lot from neocon types over the last several decades before Trump. And they've been saying the same thing, and I've been fighting against them. No, he's good. He's doing the right thing. I will admit that I'm a little surprised that that Linda is as willing to cut Biden some slack on this as someone on the podcast who I place sort of in that camp a little bit. Whereas I am a Democrat and am sometimes quite skeptical of some neoconish, hawkish policies. But this way of doing it, it just looks like a big old mess to me. I give him tons of credit, Biden, for Ukraine and how he stuck with them and fought for the aid and the weapons when it was so difficult for all these months, let alone from the very beginning. But the way this is playing out in the context of the protests and everything, it looks to me like kind of confused and pretty weak.
Well, on that subject, Greg, Donald Trump is an expert at transforming everything into a dominance competition. And he is the strong one, and his opponent is weak and corrupt. And honestly, that's how he is going to present this move by Biden. It's going to be Biden is caving to the lefties in his party, which is a well-worn theme on the right anyway. A lot of people think he has already caved to the left on too many occasions. It's going to be portrayed that way. Do you think it makes him look weak?
Yeah, and thank you for not asking me to weigh in on the conflict, because I'm not a foreign policy analyst. So I'm not going to start with
particular
conflict. But so I'll be shallow and talk about the politics. But yeah, no, I think it's an effective hit, and it's an effective hit in part because there's some truth to it. You know, and this is, forgive me for waving the judicial conservative bloody shirt, but like back in the Bork hearings, Biden famously went out before Bork was nominated, responding to rumors it might be Bork, and said to the press, if it's Bork, I'll have to support him. I'm going to catch hell from the left, but I'm going to fight for him because it's the right thing to do. And of course, as soon as he caught hell from the left, he went to a 180 and kind of led the inquisition. I think Biden does have a through line of moderate inclinations, but a bit of an anxiety about his left. And I think there's been lots of instances of that, and it's not a good look. And I think, towards what Damon was saying before, we have, I think, three presidents in a row now, very different presidents, who, for different reasons, had openings to appeal to the broad center and try to force a realignment, and I think largely chose not to. And we haven't had a president that had significant crossover support since W. Bush, and that was only in the wake of 9/11. And it's a very peculiar place to be in American history, and it's not good for our constitutional structure, when we really need a president who is not just a leader of the party, but the head of state. So sort of a constitutional perspective, I worry about it. From a political perspective, I think it can sting. And of course, Trump is all over the place on all this, and he's going to portray himself as the friend of America's Jews while he's having dinner with literal neo-Nazis. So, you know, he doesn't have the cleanest hit, but somehow he seems to be able to get away with it over and over again, which is something I can't explain.
All right. I think after that conversation, we need to hear about BetterHelp. Let's take a moment to talk about mental health. We all have struggles, but they don't have to control us. Therapy can help so much. It is not just for people with serious trauma or major illness. We all need a sympathetic, dispassionate listener, someone with experience and perspective who can reassure us that others have the same insecurities, doubts, and fears and have overcome them. Therapy helps us to figure out how our own minds may be holding us back. Ruminating about our worries and conflicts or the many balls we're trying to keep in the air doesn't help. It just contributes to the stress. And self-medicating with booze or drugs is a dead end. Therapy can help unwind your worries and let you be a calmer, happier version of yourself. If you're thinking of starting therapy, BetterHelp is a great option. It's incredibly convenient because it's entirely online, flexible, and suited to your schedule. You just fill out a questionnaire and get matched with a licensed therapist and then get started. If that therapist isn't a good fit, you can switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. It's the gift you give yourself. Make your brain your friend with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/begtodiffer today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/begtodiffer. All right, ladies and gentlemen, we cannot conclude this podcast before we get to our highlight or lowlight of the week without noticing the most bizarre story, maybe the most emblematic story of the week, which is Robert F. Kennedy Jr. when he was in the midst of his second divorce trial and there was the discussion of alimony. He was explaining why he could not provide alimony to wife number two because he couldn't really earn money because he had mental problems. And why did he have mental problems? Because a worm ate his brain. So, I mean, here in the deposition, he said that, yes, his health issues were caused by a worm that got into a brain and ate a portion of it and then died, unquote. So I just open it up to the group to say any comments, maybe there are more people in our national life who have brain worms and that would explain a lot. I don't know. Linda, what do you
think? I'm going to weigh in here. Mona, I don't know what's happened to Beg to Differ, but we started off the show essentially alluding to Donald Trump's in his boxer shorts in a hotel room with Stormy Daniels and we're ending it with the brain worm in RFK Jr.'s past. So I just, what can you say about this? It does explain a lot about maybe his current positions.
Oh my gosh. Yes. Apparently he's also hepped up on steroids and anyway, but you know, why should that cause anyone to doubt whether he's fit for the presidency when you consider those that are currently considered fit? All right. Anybody else? Anything? No? Okay. We'll leave it there. Yeah. Oh, Bill, go. Yes.
Inquiring pundits want to know which part of his brain was consumed. Was it perhaps the prefrontal cortex?
I was about to say, yeah. The part that's responsible for judgment and discretion. Oh, gosh. God. All right.
How did we get here?
Oh, unbelievable. Okay. Well, let's turn now to our highlight or lowlight of the week and start with Linda.
Thanks, Mona. And I'm going from the ridiculous to the sublime with my
Please.
Highlight of the week. I want to highlight an article. It's actually the cover of at the Atlantic this month, the June Atlantic, and it's by Ann Applebaum. And I have to tell you, this article reminded me a great deal of the article that led to my becoming a Republican in the first place. And that was an article in 1979 by Jean Kirkpatrick in Commentary called Dictatorships and Double Standards. It's not because that's what Ann Applebaum is talking about, but what it says to me is how far the Republican Party has come in those intervening 45 years. because what Anne Applebaum is describing in her article, which is entitled Democracy is Losing the Propaganda War, is how autocrats in China, Russia, and other countries around the world have made common cause with MAGA Republicans in order to discredit liberalism and freedom. And it is a stunning piece. It is, I guess, an excerpt from a book she's about to publish. I recommend it to everyone. I think it's very sober reading. And as someone who became a Republican in part because of Jean Kirkpatrick, if I were still a Republican today, Anne Applebaum's article would make me give up my membership in that party.
Thank you. Greg Nunziata.
Can I give you a high and a low quickly?
You bet.
So we did a program this week in the Society for the Rule of Law on student loan forgiveness by this administration and its implications for the rule of law. One of our panelists wrote a really long article in New York Times Opinion this week called This is Peak College Admissions Insanity. And it's a terrific read. It's an aspect of the debates around what's going on colleges that I was not aware of. And I think both parents and people who kind of care about the future of higher education really should give it a read. The low light for me was Speaker Johnson. After riding high in lots of regards and surprising me a couple of times, is back to sowing doubts about the legitimacy of our elections. And he had a press conference on the steps of the Capitol this week with some of Trump's inner circles, folks who were involved in the late unpleasantness, and purportedly in support of a bill that would outlaw voting by illegal aliens, who, of course, cannot vote already. Whatever the merits of the bill, the thrust of the press conference was to raise questions again about the last presidential election and sow doubt about the legitimacy of the next one. And I'm really disappointed that he would lend the prestige of his office to this initiative, particularly when he's in a more secure footing and seems unnecessary for his own survival.
Excellent point. Bill Galston.
Well, I'm going to violate custom, at least my custom, by turning my gaze upward to a highlight, as opposed to downward. I read a terrific piece on a topic that I didn't think could hold my attention for a page. It was an article by David Reif entitled Lieberland, Populism, Peronism, and Madness in Argentina. And it is superbly written, you know, enthrallingly interesting. I couldn't stop reading it, in part for the quality of the prose, and in part because of his ability in a very low-key way to convey just how crazy things have become in a country that used to be among the most developed and prosperous in the entire world. And when you consider his provenance, he is the son of Philip Reif, you know, who wrote, among other classics, The Triumph of the Therapeutic, which is my nominee for the single most important impression book written in the 1960s, and Susan Sontag. You know, she was a student in one of Reif's classes. She was 17 years old, and they got married. And I can only imagine what growing up in that household must have been like. But he is worthy of his parents and just as interesting as they are. So that's my recommendation. This article can be found in Leon Wieseltier's incomparable journal, Liberties.
Thank you for that. I just have a quick follow-up question, though. So I will read it. I'm interested in this very much because you often see the statistic that, you know, I forget, it was in like 1900 or something, the U.S. economy and Argentina's were roughly the same size. Mm-hmm. And Argentina, a lot of people thought, was going to be the up-and-coming power in the world and to have a rapidly growing economy. They had all of the natural resources and many other advantages that we also had, and yet they went so sideways with Perón, and it destroyed the country. Is that the import?
Pretty much, except that although it's the decline and fall started with Perón, it didn't end there. right?
Yeah,
that somehow his particular brand of, you know, of aggressive populism distorted all of the other political forces in the country until finally there was no basis of sanity to be found anywhere.
That doesn't sound familiar at all. Okay. All right. Thank you for that. Damon.
Well, this has been great today. I'm a huge fan of David Reif. I love Weasel Tears of Liberties. I also loved Ann Applebaum's essay in The Atlantic that Linda plugged. So, you know, we're on a roll here. My highlight is also an essay. This is by someone I know I've plugged before on here once or twice. It's Brink Lindsay of the Niskanen Center. So a colleague of mine and Linda's there. One of my favorite writers. He has a very good Substack called The Permanent Problem, and he wrote a piece about a week ago for them titled The Curse of Presentism, which is a really nice, substantive essay about the fact that I think, you know, is true and distressing, that there are all kinds of things about our moment that show us that we are moving into a kind of culture that is increasingly disconnected from knowledge of history. And this is an old lament, you know, the old line, Americans are an ahistorical nation. But if that is a national tendency, it's being exacerbated and augmented by technological innovations and the way that information is being stored and transmitted. And Lindsay really does a great job of plunging into the many layers of this problem to show both why it's happening, how it's happening, and some reflecting some on the pretty scary consequences of a culture that is constantly kind of reacquainting itself with basic facts of the world anew with each new generation, because nothing is handed down from one generation to the next. So very much appreciate that. And there'll be a link to it in the show notes so readers can find it.
Thank you. Well, I came prepared with some extras because actually the Ann Applebaum piece was one I was also going to recommend. So I will cite a statement that came out by more than 400 Columbia University Jewish students about what's been going on at that campus and about their feelings about themselves as Jews and their feelings about Israel and about democracy and pluralism. It was an appeal to those who hate them that they are, you know, we are your fellow students. And if you would have coffee with us, you'd find that, you know, perhaps we don't disagree as much as you think. But yes, we do affirm that Israel has a right to exist and that Israel is not a settler colonialist nation. And they point out that Jews have been the victims of prejudice and persecution from every direction, from the you know, right for being communists, and from the left for being capitalists, and from the Islamists for being Jews. And so it's a quite eloquent statement of solidarity and resistance to the current moment. And it will also be in the show notes. And I recommend it. It was a bracing read. And with that, I would like to thank Greg Nunziata for joining us. Thank you so much. And of course, my regular panel. I also want to thank our producer, Jim Swift, and our sound engineer, Jonathan Seary, and of course, our great listeners and viewers. And Beg to Differ will return next week, as every week.